Hi, listeners, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, Australia's premier podcast series on everything you ever wanted to know about the National Disability Insurance Scheme. I'm your host, Dr. George Talaforis, and on today's episode, we're talking about support coordination, what it takes to be a support coordinator, and how to run an effective support coordination business. I couldn't think of anyone better than Jess Stubbins, founder and director of AbleWing, to help us to dive deep into this topic. She set up a support coordination business when the NDIS first started, and she's got a real passion for independent support coordination. Hi, Jess. Welcome to the show.
Hey, George. Thank you very much for having me.
So tell me, what's AbleWing?
What's AbleLink? So AbleLink is an NDIS registered provider of support coordination. We are an independent provider in that we only provide support coordination across Victoria.
And how long have you been running this, and why did you decide to start a business doing support coordination?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, so how long have we been running? We're going into our third year of running. And how it all came about was I had been working in a bit of the readiness space in the rollout in NEMA in Victoria. And I really saw this great need for independent support coordinators, and could see that the role of a support coordinator was going to be so integral to success of the scheme. And so it all came about. I decided I would sort of go out on my own as a sole trader and do a bit of pre-planning and help people get ready for the NDIS in with the vision to then, you know, develop into the support coordination space. And so if I think about the vision of running a business as such, at the beginning it was very much I was a one-man show and had thought a little bit about working with a few people. But now running AbleLink, it's far more. I talk about it, yes, it's a business, but we now run an organization, really. We are a team of 21, and three of those people are admin-based roles. And really, the way that the organization has sort of organically evolved has really been driven by being quite a sort of a flat organization, in that we don't have a lot of levels within AbleLink, and everyone's really the culture of the organization has been sort of at the front of everything we've done to try and, you know, really harness as much energy as we can from people into their support coordination role and not get caught up in any unnecessary day-to-day activities that aren't really focused on valuing the sort of diversity of our team, as well as trying to sort of shape what we feel our best support coordination is.
Just listening to that, I'm thinking you've gone from not having a business to having this like business where you employ 21 people, and that's pretty exciting.
It is exciting. It has been,
and I think, oh my god, I've done this. This is pretty awesome.
Regularly, I think there's moments of wow, we've done this, and also moments of like, holy moly, what have we done? And I think that's quite key in that we have chosen to employ a number of staff, and they are sort of permanent employees. So I think it's an amazing thing to reflect on the sort of name that has been built around AbleLink, based on the incredible team that have worked really hard over the last 3 years. But then also the realization that it's a very real thing. You know, we as business owners, we are responsible to ensure that people are, you know, maintain a secure role and are supported in a way that ensures that they can, you know, maintain resilience in quite a complex role as well. So, yeah, it's the balance of, wow, look what we've done, as well as, whew, it's big.
You must be in a position now where you've kind of, you know, set yourself up financially as well.
Yeah. I'd say, you know, as I'd mentioned in terms of being quite lean, we're feeling really quite lucky in terms of how we had chosen to structure the logistically structure AbleLink from the beginning. So we set up as a remote team, and everyone was set up to work from home. And now in the sort of current landscape of the dreaded coronavirus and the way that teams and workplaces are needing to adapt, we feel quite lucky that we already had structures in place for people to work remotely. But I think that was also a decision that we wanted to keep our overheads really, really low, and have managed to do so to a large extent. But finance,
it's important, isn't it, to keep the overheads low, because there's not a huge margin when you look at the unit price for support coordination. It's about $95 an hour.
Yeah, $98.06 in its current.
Oh, it's gone up. You know, that's quite a. I mean, it's not nothing, but it's not like what, you know, occupational therapists are working with, or, getting $200 an hour. How do you run a business on that unit price?
Yeah, you know, it's a big question. And you asked, you know, are we financially stable now? And I would say absolutely we are. Anyone thinking about getting into running a support coordination business, you're not jumping in it to make a lot of money by any means. I think it's really, really important to sort of keep in mind, although an organization can be quite lean, there are still some ongoing running costs. And that $98.06, that figure sounds quite a bit. You know, if you consider sort of a general hourly rate for a support coordinator to be paid is, you know, can range between $32 to $40 on average. That's a pretty big chunk that you're keeping it every hour. But really, when you start to run the numbers on somebody working, say, in a full-time role and what that actually means to be capturing their time, as well as the costs that go along with that. And we've focused quite hard on being quite transparent with our team, because I can imagine if I was a support coordinator and I'm working in a full-time role, I can do the numbers. You know, if I need to work at an 80% efficiency, which is pretty standard across the board for support coordination businesses, you know, 80% means hitting 30 hours of billable within a full-time week. And that's pretty much what a lot of people have decided is the balance to being viable. But if I'm a support coordinator and I'm adding up my 30 hours at $98.06 and my wage isn't really matching that, I'm probably going to have a few questions. But I think that's where we've tried to be quite transparent in helping the team to understand all of the running costs that go along with, you know, some management of an organization, the systems that are required in order to be sort of efficient at the role, the equipment that's required. Then there's work cover, there's portable long service leave, there's super. You know, I think when you start to put all of those numbers into place, it is a business that can be sustainable by all means, and you can pay people in a way that really, you know, values the work that they do. But to be rolling in it from support coordination, no, not so much.
I think that point that you make is one that I really agree with, that you need to be transparent with your staff in terms of making it clear that, yes, you might be paid maybe 50% less of the hourly rate, but these are all the things that you get for that difference, I guess.
That's right.
And being open and honest, people are like, okay, I'll do it. Or, hey, if they don't like it, they can go off and set themselves up, you know, separately if that's what they want to do.
That's right. And I think, you know, that's the big consideration for people who would be thinking about starting a business that as a, potentially a sole trader. You know, there is certainly you've got less opportunity to scale, but then your running costs will be significantly less if you're going to be a one-man band as well. So, you know, your margins could be greater.
Yeah, I can see that. I want to understand, like, the typical day of a support call note. I mean, I imagine it's kind of all where there is no typical day, because you're based on what the person needs. But just maybe, is it possible to talk me through what a day might look like?
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, as you said, there is no typical day. But I mean, a day may entail meeting with people out and about to, you know, have a catch up and look at what's, I mean, if you're setting up someone's plan when you first engage with them to understand exactly what an NDIS plan means to them. I think that's a really key thing to begin with when you're sort of building the foundations is, you know, your NDIS goals are pretty general, but can we feel certain that as a support coordinator, we actually understand what those goals mean to somebody in the real world? And so, you know, your day might be spent meeting with people in person. It could, there's a lot of time spent on helping people to budget their funds and make sure that, you know, the services that they're connecting with that are NDIS funded can be accounted for. One thing that we're seeing now as we move into that, people who have got their second and their third plans, is you're no longer necessarily meeting with someone in person or over video meeting to help people to feel calm about what's happening and the changes, but we really are now focusing on what are the skills that people are wanting to build in terms of managing their own supports or, you know, the nice creative stuff. And I think that sort of work is now happening for support coordinators now that we've moved through that sort of really rocky transition phase for a lot of people. Another thing that's really key, I think, to note for a support coordinator is your day might be spent doing quite a bit of reading. And I think it's really important to note within this role is that things are obviously ever changing in the NDIS space, but also I think a key responsibility to being a support coordinator is knowing that you have a responsibility to have an incredibly deep understanding of the NDIS far above and beyond what a participant or their supports may be expected to have, and you sort of play that consultancy role. So yeah, the reading and trying to sort of digest and interpret changes is a really key part of a day as well.
Yeah, and that's I like that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one thing that I like about being in policy is that you get to learn every day. When, you know, sometimes in other jobs it's like just come in and do the job, but it's like no. In roles like support coordination, you need to constantly upskill yourself. Yeah. Notice that this is an upskill. And that's something that can be really enjoyable and fulfilling.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, if I think of the people on our team, the real NDIS nerds are the ones that sort of they thoroughly enjoy challenging, you know, an interpretation of some legislation. And yeah, that is enriching to them. And again,
yeah,
they
kind of bed with Section 34 of the NDIS Act.
That's,
you know,
right.
Memorizing it. That's what I like to do. Reasonable and necessary.
Yep. Our team works quite a bit in the SDA space, understanding the SDA legislation. And yep. And I think, you know, that it's really empowering to a support coordinator as well. We've worked in with not a lot of clarity around framework as to what support coordination is and isn't. And my personal opinion on that is there's some greatness that has come from that, because especially within our team, we've been able to shape some of the tools and approaches that we use, because it has not been super prescriptive from the agency as to what support coordination is and isn't. And we constantly dance the dance between being what is a support coordinator and what is a case manager and an advocate, and knowing that it's quite a delicate dance across some of the functions of an advocate and a case manager, and how that does sort of, you know, spill a little bit into the support coordination role. But I think when a support coordinator is able to really take the reins on information and interpret those changes, it's incredibly empowering to know that you're in a role that can help to disperse that information. And then we're moving into that, you know, capacity building, helping people to think in a different way about utilizing supports or connecting with community. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's very important that you use all those skills.
Yeah.
And when you're interviewing someone for a role as a support coordinator, what do you look for?
Yeah, what do we look for? So I think it is key that someone is able to communicate in a calm manner, and someone who I've always within our interviews thrown sort of total curveball questions to see how somebody may respond to that, and if they can respond with a bit of humor, brilliant. But so flexible thinkers as well. So someone who is able to communicate well, they're flexible in their thinking. A big plus for anyone who does come along and is an NDIS nerd. And another key area that we would try to gauge during recruitment would be someone's ability to really understand the importance of boundaries within a role like this. I know there's a number of interviews that we've had with people who are all incredibly well-meaning, but, you know, their need to help people comes through really, really strongly, as opposed to work alongside somebody. So I think it's really key when gauging somebody's maturity and approach to such a role is their ability to be able to define what those boundaries look like, because another very, very important part of being a support coordinator is the ability to have some resilience in the role, and those two things sort of go hand in hand.
I like that, and I also think that raises the important point around that you're there not to do, you know, you said to support a person, not to do everything for them.
Yeah.
But it's also around building their capacity to hopefully not need you at some point, that they've gotten to a point where they've learned what they need to know. They've got the skills that they need to implement their plan, and that through having the coaching, like the support, that coaching support of a support coordinator, they can then do things more themselves. Because ultimately, that's the aim, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, we're working with such a diverse range of people and their support networks, that capacity building work needs to, you know, looks so different across many people that we're working with. And I think the point that we're moving now past transition is really key. As support coordinators and our networks across the country have sort of understood a little bit more about how we can be assisting people with capacity building, we're feeling more comfortable with that. But also think the majority of people that we've been working with are far more willing to work on building capacity that is now not as scary as it may have been in their first or their second plan. I think it's – and obviously building that confidence in people takes time. One of the key things I think is really important is being able to lead by example. And it comes back to that dance of, oh, no, I'm a support coordinator, I don't do that. And that dance of being delicate around, you know, case managing and support coordination. And I think if you're able to identify early on for somebody what it actually means to be in control of their supports, that's quite integral into creating an action plan as to how you will help someone over the life of a plan. But then being able to know how far to push someone's involvement, as well as knowing how not to set up dependencies on yourself. And I think being able to lead by example, I mean, a really simple example would be support coordinators don't do rostering. But if it means that a support coordinator helps to really intensely work with someone to look at what a roster could be, and then there's the involvement in helping people to understand what a roster costs, and, you know, the ins and outs of different organizational positions and policy and shift times and cancellations, it may mean that you, for the first sort of, you know, 6 months potentially, you're quite heavily involved in that rostering because you've then invested the time into helping people to feel comfortable to do it themselves, as opposed to, you know, really being quite arm's length with that role and it taking a much longer time for somebody. So I think, without babbling too much, I think it's quite obvious that it's a very individual approach to what capacity building means for a particular person. But again, we're being able to do a lot more of that now that services are settling and people are far more set up with their plans moving into their second and third plan.
And it might be not, I mean, that's really, you know, important for people to understand that it might not, the do's and don'ts are complicated, right?
Yeah.
It might not be that you're doing it, but you might be teaching someone how to do it. And in doing that, you do it.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And, you know, I think something that we're getting better at within our team now is helping people to develop resources. So whether that resource may be they've, you know, now tried out 5 different providers and they've found a provider that they like for now for their, say, their personal supports in the home. Every time that we've gone through the process of connecting with a new supports, they've had to retell components of their story in their life, whether it be, you know, manual handling instructions or particular intricacies that of the way someone likes to run their home. Being able to get together those type of individual resources for people is just so, so important, because then they feel potentially empowered to then, when you're no longer around, to engage with a new provider and go, well, these are my rules, you know. But it's just the simple act of being able to capture those things. Which sounds quite simple, but, you know, it's quite a challenging thing to do, and it takes time to build rapport and understand somebody in order to help them to capture that type of information.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And when you talk about capacity building, you've said that it's very different for different people, but I'd imagine that sometimes it's about the family as well. It's not necessarily just the person with a disability. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I would say it's a good 50% of the people that we're working with that it is. You know, they're certainly at the center of the work we're doing, but the interactions that you're having are a majority with their supports around them and their families. And that can be a big old challenge too sometimes, you know, trying to challenge the way that things have always been done within a household, where we don't want to be the expert on what should or should not be done, but we can see that things potentially could be done a different way to really enhance somebody's life and challenge the norm. So that's delicate balance between boundaries but also pushing the boundaries.
I think you need a lot of emotional intelligence when working with families. You need to know how far you can push your your thoughts and opinions.
Yes.
And at the same time, be respectful of family values and the history that families have.
That's right. That's right. And you know, and then that's where it doesn't necessarily take just one plan with support coordination to build that type of relationship and rapport where families trust you. You know, you may be the 40th person that's come into their lives and ask them to do a particular task, or, you know, suggested that we do things a particular way. And it takes, you know, for people who have had service systems in their lives for many, many years, there's walls that you need to slowly chip away at for very good reasons.
And in the end, I mean, the support coordinator works across systems. So you might be, you know, implementing someone's NDIS plan, but that also means that you need to interact with health or, you know, criminal justice or different types of systems, education, and that sort of thing, employment. I don't know. How do you work across systems and not get overwhelmed?
Oh, it's a great question. And I think, you know, it's a great challenge because we've got a role to work with funded support systems, as well as connect people with other, you know, and ensure that things can run as smoothly as they possibly can. But I think where there are a number of systems that do not work cohesively together, it can be a really, really frustrating component of our work. Just recently, we've been working across health and the justice system with a particular person, and it has been so challenging from a support coordinator's perspective to try and get people to talk, to ensure that this person is well supported. But it seems as though quite often when we're dealing with a number of support systems, you're having really siloed discussions. And that's where, you know, if a support coordinator is skilled enough to facilitate sort of care team type functions around somebody, you're going to see the best outcomes. But I think there's a lot of blood, sweat and tears that needs to go into that work. And again, you know, someone may have never had a support coordinator, may have never had anything to do with the justice system. So understanding things like how a court functions or what court orders mean, you know, may be a really big part of just enhancing your understanding of those support systems. Because, I mean, we can certainly try and harness experts within our team. And I think that's something that we've tried to do within our organization is, you know, there are some people that understand the aged care system really well. And we've got some guys that come from justice systems. So trying to harness some specialties within your team is a really key sort of way to not need everybody to be an expert in everything, because you can't possibly be an expert in everything.
We want to know that if we have particular challenges, like health system challenges or justice system challenges, that there are support coordinators out there that have a level of specialization or deeper knowledge in those areas. I think that's very useful.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's no secret. DSC have done it really well. Over the last 3 years, have really encouraged people working within the support coordination space to think about what that specialty is within your service or your organization. So being able to really hone in on a particular area of specialty is key to, I think, being a support coordinator that continues to flourish, you know, as transition has occurred and we move into, you know, the next 5 years. If you have a particular specialty, you're well positioned to continue to capture referrals, I suppose.
Absolutely. I want to just end with a few bits of advice for people. So I want you to hit back on, you know, what you've been doing this for maybe 5 years now. What have you learned? What are some of the the main key things that you've learned that you were sitting you from day one?
Yeah, wow. So I think I, by nature, am a bit of a people pleaser. And so personally for me, being able to really had I developed an ability to not create dependencies on myself early on, it's really, really challenging to do. There are, you know, I think the majority of people that are in this space as support coordinators, that is by nature, we're helpy helpers. But knowing that creating dependencies early on then makes putting boundaries in place very, very challenging. What else? The importance of documenting information early. And so something that we have done is we focused a lot on putting systems in place that mean that we're not repeating a lot of information. And how that sort of developed over the last few years had, if anyone is thinking about setting up a business, how the information that they're capturing can be, you know, repeated, whether it's your notes or your reporting, is
yeah,
really
because important. It can be a repetitive role, like you know, having if you do a review of a plan, if you're going in for a review, you know, you want to have a template ready to fill in rather than do it from scratch every time.
That's right. And I mean, so something we do now is once we've set someone up in our system, we're able to then throughout the year when we're speaking and meeting with people, we're able to continually note progress or barriers and outcomes on particular goals, so that at the end of the year, when we're developing our end of year plan review report, we're not starting from scratch. You know, it's the all of those tiny little things that have happened throughout the year that we haven't now forgotten because it's been captured.
Very important. What about the whole daunting aspect of the audits? Have you learned anything about audits and how to deal with auditing?
Yeah, man. Well, like, you know, audits were so scary when we went through our first audit. It was like, oh my goodness, we've got people coming to just spy through all of our information. But really, they were just on board to help us consider some things that we hadn't. And there was very much that opportunity to talk through with the auditor why we were or weren't doing things. And then we had the opportunity to put them in place. So audits aren't scary. That's been a big learning. Audits might be expensive, but they're not scary. And I think we've got our audit under quality and safeguards coming up in the next 2 months. And for us, again, it's a really good opportunity to make sure that files are clean and we're up to scratch with, you know, things that we like to set a certain AbleLink standard, and, you know, having the opportunity to do an internal audit prior to somebody coming is really valuable.
And what do you think is the future of support coordination? Do you think that it's something that, you know, will eventually dry up? It sounds like you don't think that.
No, I don't think that. I do know, like, I'm quite certain that with, you know, once we've moved completely through rollout, that the numbers of support people getting support coordination will decrease, most certainly, because there are so many people that just needed a hand to transition in, understand the fundamentals of the NDIS, and then they are good to go. They may then throughout their life have a big change, whether it be moving or, you know, whatever it may be within a different life stage, they may then re-engage support coordination. But there will always be the group of people with incredibly complex needs that will need support coordination ongoing. There will always be people entering the scheme. And I do believe that the you know, what was intended for the LAC function to help with implementation can work really well. But support coordination for a group of people that really require more of a complex support will need to be funded through support coordination. So I do believe that support coordination will be ongoing, the numbers will be less. But there'll always be a need for it in some type of form, whether or not we need to then evolve the way that we do work, which would be great.
It's been a really useful discussion. Anything else you'd like to say?
No, I think that's it. You know, I think running a business and running an organization in a space that is so incredibly new and evolving is really exciting. And I've always said to our team, you know, we'll look back in history and go, we were a bloody great part of that, and can feel really, really confident that we have sort of put a lot of time and effort and energy and real passion into kind of being an integral part of Scheme success. So anyone who's really thinking about getting into this space and thinking about potentially starting up a little business, I would say go for it. It's not going to be all roses, but go for it. I think it's a really empowering opportunity to do something with some real meat.
So, absolutely. Yeah. Do your homework.
Do your homework.
Find out what you need to know, and talk to others about what they've done.
Yeah, talking with others.
A lot of Facebook groups out there that have some really helpful information that you can ask questions and share.
And you know, George, over the last few years, those networks nationally have strengthened so much in our space, and those Facebook groups are really, really useful to connect with people, especially if you're not working with a team. So, well, yes. George, thank you for having a chat.
And I wish you well with cabling.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Bye. That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. Check out our Facebook page for all previous podcasts and transcripts. We love hearing from you, so please leave your comments and suggestions for future episodes. Until next time, stay well and reasonable.